of USA Today. It's my pleasure to be hosting Diane's podcast. On my mind this week, Senate GOP leaders are pushing ahead for a vote next week on their version of a health care reform bill. Wall Street Journal reporter Louise Radnofsky explains the specifics of the new proposal and the behind-the-scenes maneuvering to get it passed in the Senate.
It appears right now under the deal that the Senate has struck that it will retain the Affordable Care Act's requirement that insurance companies sell coverage to everybody, regardless of their medical history, at the same price. That is huge.
Then, a boost for President Trump and a discouraging reality check for Democrats. Josh Krauthaar of National Journal on what Tuesday's special House election in Georgia means for the 2018 midterms.
The Democratic path to winning the House is sort of by taking some of these tough seats. And if you can't win a district like Georgia 6, doesn't mean the Democrats can't win back the House, but it makes it tougher than advertised.
First, here's Louise Radnofsky of The Wall Street Journal. We reached her at her office. Hey, Louise, thanks for joining us.
Thank you for having me.
You know, congressional Republicans have been promising to repeal the Affordable Care Act almost since it passed. Now we finally have the Senate unveiling its version of a new bill. Does it deliver on repealing Obamacare?
That is the key question for Republican senators in particular to figure out over the next few days. There are some, particularly on the right end of the party spectrum in Congress, that believe that what is on the table doesn't do that. And they have suggested as a result that they can't support it. At the same time, there are centrists who believe that the bill already goes too far in stripping away parts of the Affordable Care Act they personally would like to keep. So there's a tug of war going on right now. And everybody is talking about whether, in their eyes, the Senate bill does do enough or does repeal the Affordable Care Act.
So how different is it from the bill in the House that actually passed last month?
In some ways, it rolls back important deals cut between House lawmakers, particularly around insurance market regulations. That's a problem for some lawmakers as a reason to withhold their support. That's the key change. There are a few tweaks to the way that Medicaid funding is calculated, but broadly speaking, it's safe to say that in the case of both bills, and certainly you'll hear this a lot from Democrats in the coming days, in both bills, Medicaid spending is capped for the first time in the program's history.
You know, that's a big difference for Medicaid, right? Because the essential nature of an entitlement program is that if you're eligible for it, you're going to get it. Would this change that aspect of Medicaid?
Yes, Medicaid's gone through a number of changes in the last 2 years, the biggest of which was brought about by the Affordable Care Act that essentially offered significant federal funding for states to expand the program for the first time to anyone who was simply poor living in the state. Before that, you qualified on the basis of being eligible because of being disabled or being a child or a pregnant woman. And this made it a program, at least in 31 states that opted into this provision, the Affordable Care Act, a program for poor people. And so this would roll some of that funding back, leaving it up to states to decide whether they could continue to let those people be eligible.
And that could affect millions of people. I think, about 11 million people became newly eligible for Medicaid through the Obamacare expansion.
Yes, and millions more enrolled in the program, although millions are eligible but haven't enrolled, as a result of the Affordable Care Act pressure on people to get insurance. In addition, one of the things that you'll hear a lot from Democrats in coming days is that changing the way that the Medicaid program as a whole is funded affects tens of millions more people who are in it. At this point, Medicaid is the biggest health program in America. It's bigger than Medicaid. It covers at least one in five Americans. And funding caps, certainly Democrats would argue, would affect everybody. Republicans would equally argue in many cases that the program has grown to a size that is already putting it on an unsustainable trajectory. And this is why they have to take action now.
So let's talk about a couple of the other specifics that we think we're going to see in the Senate bill. One is protections for people who have pre-existing medical conditions. That was a big part of the debate in the House. How does the Senate bill handle that?
Appears right now under the deal that the Senate has struck that it will retain the Affordable Care Act's requirement that insurance companies sell coverage to everybody, regardless of their medical history, at the same prices with limited variation based on age. That is huge. That was a major change in the way insurance is priced and sold in the United States when Democrats included it in the 2010 health law, and it looks at this point as if it's going to survive through the Republican bill. That's a problem for Republican conservatives who think that that provision certainly has driven up premiums for healthy people, but at the same time may do enough to console centrist Republicans who are concerned about retaining something that is broadly popular when people talk about it without regard to its price.
You know, one of the provisions that's gotten a lot of debate is whether the new version of healthcare is going to effectively defund Planned Parenthood. What would happen with Planned Parenthood with this bill?
Well, there's a delicate balancing act there. Broadly speaking, the bill would seek to cut federal funding for any services going to a clinic that is affiliated with Planned Parenthood because it provides abortion. In addition, federal funding does not currently go towards abortion in most circumstances, but the argument that anti-abortion activists have made for years is that Planned Parenthood can essentially be subsidized by the federal government for the abortion work that it does, even if the funds are flowing for reproductive health services of other types, such as contraception. The issue is complicated in part because there's a tug of war over whether to do it. There are at least two senators in the Republican caucus where, again, they can only afford to lose two votes at most, for whom Planned Parenthood could be a deal breaker. They want to keep the funding in place. But it's also complicated for procedural reasons. Because of the path that Republicans have taken to repealing the Affordable Care Act, or large chunks of it, through the budget process, they only have to get 50 votes for it. They don't need to get 60. But at the same time, they're procedurally limited in what they can do. And it's not yet clear that the parliamentarian will allow the Planned Parenthood provisions to remain in place.
So that the procedure may determine that very political battle.
Procedure may determine it, and politics may deliver it.
Let's talk about one other thing, which is the funding, $45 billion to treat opioid addiction. This is a big cause for a couple key senators, Rob Portman of Ohio, Susan Collins of Maine. Is that in this bill?
It doesn't appear to be in the bill right now, which is not to say that it couldn't be in the bill. That's because, as we understand it, the bill that has been drafted right now is largely going to remain the same after it's been scored by the Congressional Budget Office. You can't make big changes to it because they can't turn around an estimate in time. But simply adding a fund of money that has a set dollar amount attached to it is the kind of change that could be made at the last minute ahead of a potential vote next Thursday. It's the kind of change we saw happen with the House legislation as well, when Congressman Fred Upton of Michigan made a late proposal that was accepted and included in the final bill.
You know, it's interesting. There's another way in which the Senate is different from the House, I believe, which is that they have to get that Congressional Budget Office score on the impact of the bill before they can vote. That wasn't a factor on the House side. When do we think the CBO score is going to come out?
As early as Monday. Right now, the Senate is heading on a very aggressive timetable. Bill released on Thursday, score released the following Monday, and then potential vote starting the following Thursday. They're also running up against a deadline that is somewhat immutable, the 4th of July holiday and the congressional recess that goes along with that. If they haven't got a vote ahead of the recess, then the recess itself becomes a little bit of a factor in whether they'll be able to get to 50 votes in the future for two reasons. One, members of constituents who don't like the bill can certainly use the recess to rally opposition to it. But in addition, some senators may feel under pressure to deliver on what was a campaign promise for, as you said right at the beginning, 7 years. And if they haven't delivered, they could find themselves under pressure when they go home for why they didn't.
You know, Louise, you called it an aggressive schedule. I really think it may be an unprecedented schedule. In the years I've been in Washington, I can't remember another time when a major bill was drafted in secret, released, and they held a vote on it the following week. How unusual is that?
Certainly people who've been around for a long time can say that it's unusual. And in the sense of there being a parliamentary procedure shift, there is certainly a departure from previous norms. But what Republicans would say by way of response is that they have run on this for 7 years. There is no surprise about what their plan, their broad plan was. They didn't run on the details of the plan, which was a strategic consideration that they certainly got criticized by some conservative health policy analysts for last year. But they also understood that running on the details would just lay the plan open to criticism from all ends. Broadly speaking, the details are not what are perturbing people. It's the big picture. You are at this point either for repealing large chunks of the Affordable Care Act, or you are not. And that is something that you've certainly heard Republican candidates talking about for as many elections as they've run in since 2010.
So 52 Republican senators, you need 50 of them to get a tie so that Vice President Pence can cast the deciding vote. What Republican senators do you think are most crucial? Who are you going to be watching?
There are actually 52 Republican senators to watch, and all of them are essentially crucial. But that's not a terribly helpful way of thinking about it. So the best way, I think, for people who are watching this at home to consider it is that there are Republicans on the right from Rand Paul, who to some extent has been counted out of the calculations by congressional leaders. They sort of privately feel as though he moves the goalposts and really shouldn't be counted on as a reliable vote either way. If he comes over, he's a bonus. But then you have a few other conservatives, Mike Lee of Utah, Ted Cruz of Texas, Senator Tom Cotton of Arkansas. And between them, they number enough senators to derail the process. On the other hand, you could give them what they're asking for, but it wouldn't necessarily lock in the senators on the other end of the spectrum. We've heard a lot about Susan Collins of Maine, Lisa Murkowski of Alaska. Those are two senators that have been willing to buck the party line in the past very openly. But behind them, there are also a number of other senators who, to varying degrees, have been public about their concerns. Dean Heller of Nevada, John McCain of Arizona. And there are some state-level concerns that kick in, for example, the Arizona insurance market is known to be fragile. Shelley Moore Capito in West Virginia has made a lot of has drawn a lot of attention to the opioid crisis in her state and states like hers. And Rob Portman of Ohio has been very vocal on the issue of Medicaid, in part because his governor, John Kasich of Ohio, has also been very vocal on the issue of Medicaid. So you have all of these folks who could push the bill in the direction that they want it to go in, as the price of their vote. And then you have about 10, 12 people that we haven't really heard from, but who could very reasonably be believed to have objections that they simply haven't decided to voice yet. And that could also change the tenor of the conversations. You could watch the 48 Democrats, but generally they've been extremely unified in being opposed to repeal of the Affordable Care Act and reluctant under any circumstances to support the GOP bill that starts with the premise of repeal. And so they, you know, if somebody were to bolt from that, that would be a very big game changer, but it seems extremely unlikely to happen. So you can take your eye off the Democrats and really focus it on 52 Republicans.
Not even a conservative Democrat like Joe Manchin of West Virginia is going to bolt from his party on this one.
That idea may have existed for about 2 days in November of last year, and it hasn't really surfaced again since.
So what's Donald Trump's, President Trump's role in all this?
It's been very low-key in the Senate. In the House, folks may remember, there was a public push by the president dialing lawmakers late into the night. The vice president tapes dozens of radio interviews in holdout members' home districts. Every faction from the House trooped through the Oval Office at some point to air their concerns somewhat publicly and to encourage the president to intervene in the dispute. We haven't seen any of that in the Senate. The White House has taken a very hands-off approach, largely leaving it to the senators to just figure things out amongst themselves. And they've sort of been cheerleading or exhorting from the sidelines, mostly by talking up the insurance market woes that they say give senators no choice but to act. That could change. We could see the White House take a more active role in pulling a few senators across the finish line. But really, they've treated the Senate differently from the House in the same way the congressional leaders sometimes treat the two chambers differently.
We had that special election in Georgia this week that got a lot of attention. The Republican One health care was one of the big issues being debated. That has the Georgia election had any kind of final effect, do you think, on this Senate debate?
I can see why people wanted to think that it could. There's a long history of health care negotiations being changed at the last minute by a surprise election, of course, most notably in the passage of the 2010 health law, when the election actually resulted in the loss of a Democratic seat and changed the Democratic majority in the Senate to get the legislation passed, and in turn changed the entire parliamentary procedure that Democrats had to use to do it. And going back into the 90s, there were also elections that seemed to give a side a mandate to go ahead and proceed with health care overhauls. But really, while there was some talk of the issue in the Georgia race, it wasn't the only issue. It wasn't the dominant issue. And the outcome in Georgia itself was unlikely either way, and is unlikely, especially with the addition of a Republican vote, to change the decision-making that the House will ultimately have on whether to accept the Senate bill.
So let's say it passes the Senate next week. It goes back to the House. Will the House accept the changes in the Senate bill, do you think?
That is going to be a great question. The House, in some ways, wanted to get the legislation off of its plate and onto the Senate's. And at the time when we asked this question, said, well, we'll cross that bridge when we come to it, if the Senate makes big changes to it that disrupt the careful balance that we struck. So we'll have to see. The House's appetite, somewhat like the Senate's appetite, will rest largely on how willing they are to engage in a protracted fight over health care to get it done, or whether they would just like to turn their attention to a tax system overhaul, which in some ways is more engaging for a large number of legislators. It's just something that they know more familiarly and care about more.
So we'll see about that. And if it goes down in defeat in the Senate, if Mitch McConnell, despite all of his legislative skills, can't get it over the finish line, does this debate stay around in Congress for the rest of the year, or do members of Congress just want to move on in any case?
It's an open question about whether the Senate, unlike the House, would be willing to have a second vote called if the first one had been either unsuccessful or, as it happened in the House, pulled at the last minute because the votes quite clearly weren't there. But regardless of whether they take another bite at a GOP bill seeking to repeal the Affordable Care Act, they will have to deal with health care over the next few months because there are a number of lingering issues that either this bill will address or, and this is something Senate Majority Leader Mitch McConnell has been telling his members, Democrats will attempt to address in a bill that they would put together that would not attempt to repeal the Affordable Care Act, but would do some of these things that are needed, according to insurers, to fix the markets. And that could be a bill that had 48 Democratic members supporting it and a handful of Republican centrists. That would be an easy bill in some ways to pass.
That'd be interesting.
Relatively
to see.
Speaking.
Yeah. Relatively easy compared to this one.
Right.
Okay, Louise, last question. You've been covering this issue for a long time. You're a big expert. Will this Senate version pass next week?
I am a big enough expert to not touch that with a barge pole. I've seen a lot of things over the last five, six years. I've seen four Supreme Court cases, the outcome of which was pretty hard to predict, and a number of surprises on the way. So I think the most important thing you can predict with healthcare is that it is always surprising.
It is always surprising. Louise, thanks so much for being with us.
My pleasure. Thank you.
And now a quick break.
DCS Daily.
DCS Daily.
DCS Daily.
It's news,
culture, and curiosities.
From the District, Tacoma Park,
Alexandria,
Friendship Heights,
Hyattsville,
Falls Church,
Northeast Washington, D.C., in your inbox every weekday afternoon.
DCS Daily.
Sign up at dcs.com/newsletter.
dcs.com/newsletter.
And we're back. And now, Josh Kraushaar, he's a political editor at National Journal. Hey, Josh, a Republican candidate won a congressional race in a district that's been safely Republican for four decades, and yet it was really discouraging for Democrats. In the end, not even that close.
Yeah, I mean, this is a race that was the most expensive in American history, the most expensive House race in American history. So there was a lot at stake. It was as if both parties were putting all their chips on the table and hoping to win. And it was very close, but ultimately Karen Handel even outperformed her own expectations to some extent and won by about 4 points in a race that is sort of a – it's not a bellwether of who's going to win the House, but it's a bellwether of whether Democrats can actually compete in these emerging suburban – traditionally conservative districts. And the Democratic path to winning the House is sort of taking some – is by taking some of these tough seats. And if you can't win a district like Georgia 6, doesn't mean the Democrats can't win back the House, but it makes it a little more challenging. It's a symbol that it might be a little tougher than advertised.
Georgia 6 is actually one of the top 10 districts in the country in terms of level of education, the percentage of voters who have college degrees. And that's why it was so tantalizing for Democrats, because that's the group – that even if they've been Republican-leaning, they tend to be pretty suspicious of Donald Trump.
It's fascinating in that the biggest dividing line in our politics, at least in last year's election, was educational attainment. And if you have a college degree, the odds are that you're voted for Hillary Clinton, you voted for Democrats for Congress. So this is the one Republican seat in that sea of college-educated districts. And yet, even though a lot of the voters in this district didn't like Donald Trump, they actually – according to a Republican strategist I talked to this week, his numbers were underwater with the voters in the district, they still cast their ballot. Enough of them still cast their ballot for the Republican congressional candidate.
So Karen Handel defeated John Ossoff, the Democratic candidate. This is for the seat that Tom Price resigned from to become Health and Human Services Secretary in the Trump administration. So what was her secret sauce? How did Karen Handel manage to hold this seat?
Well, she basically rallied the traditional Republican base. I mean, this is a district that had been solidly Republican for generations, ever since it was basically drawn in the 90s. Newt Gingrich, held it during his speakership, and it's been a district that Mitt Romney won by 20 points in 2012. It saw this remarkable shift in last year's election, where what was once a safely Republican seat all of a sudden was a toss-up in the presidential race, and Donald Trump only won it by a point and a half. So there was this wide range of up for grabs voters. These are people that usually vote Republican, moderate types of voters who had gravitated towards the Democrats. And a lot of them actually did vote for John Ossoff. But what Handel was able to do was win every single voter pretty much who voted for Donald Trump. She held the Republican base and won enough of those sort of skeptical Republicans who weren't really sold with Trump's administration. And that was enough to win by a very narrow margin in what usually is a pretty solidly Republican seat.
You know, we say it's a narrow margin, but 4 percentage points doesn't seem that narrow in a race that had so much attention and one where Democrats really thought they had a chance to win.
Psychologically, this has a big effect on the Democratic Party and also the Republican Party. Republicans were worried that if they lost a seat that had been in their hands for so long, you would see a wave of retirements. You would see seats that would open up, which would give Democrats renewed opportunity to really compete in more districts. Instead, what you're seeing is the Democratic Party that is feeling disillusioned. Nancy Pelosi is under fire today. She was the symbol of sort of the Republican ads on television in the district. Almost every ad, whether it was from the outside group, whether it was from Karen Handel herself, focused on Pelosi as the person who essentially trying to connect Ossoff to Pelosi.
When Nancy wants to raise taxes or increase spending or stop giving those military people the stuff they use to make war, we know John Ossoff will be right there to support her. That's what
raising questions about Ossoff's ideology, whether he was really a liberal in moderates' clothing. And that was really effective. It really was enough to persuade people who weren't sold with Donald Trump's performance in office but really don't like Nancy Pelosi and don't like the liberalism of the National Democratic Party.
Here's the extraordinary thing. Nancy Pelosi was a bigger problem for the Democratic candidate than Donald Trump was for the Republican candidate.
Yeah. Nancy Pelosi's – I was sort of stunned when I was asking some Republican operatives who were working on ads. I'm like, you really – these are cookie-cutter ads. These are ads that don't seem to really have a whole lot of creativity behind them. They're just putting Nancy Pelosi's face and John Ossoff's face, and that's all you're doing. But it turned out they had polling. They had a lot of data that suggested that was the most effective line of attack. And Donald Trump's numbers for all his problems were – just basically even Steven in the district. About half of the voters liked him, half of the voters didn't. Nancy Pelosi had disapproval ratings of upwards of 60-65% in that district.
And of course, we've seen Nancy Pelosi's face and image in San Francisco Liberal being used by Republicans in many districts. She's known as a very effective legislator. She's an effective fundraiser. But does the fact that this was such an effective tactic being used against what was supposed to be a very competitive race, does that in any way imperil her continued leadership of the Democratic Party in the House?
I think she'll hang on at least until the 2018 midterms. And if Democrats fall short or you don't live up to their expectations and don't win back the House, then I think you may have a renewed leadership fight. But it's really, as much criticism as Pelosi is getting, it's really less about Pelosi and more about the direction of the National Democratic Party and, frankly, how far to the left it's moved in recent years. And you can run candidates like Ossoff. You can have someone who claims to be a centrist, who claims in his own advertising that he was a bipartisan problem solver. But there's a lot of suspicion that once he gets to Washington, he's going to vote with Democratic leadership, and he really isn't going to be independent. And they're going all the way back to Obamacare, the Obamacare vote in 2010, there were a lot of Democratic members of Congress who lost their seats because they took tough votes that were to the left of their districts. So Democrats are still dealing with sort of the baggage, the psychological baggage of, how do you run as an independent? How do you convince these skeptical voters that you really are going to be more moderate and more independent?
There are some Bernie Sanders type Democrats who think John Ossoff should have run a much more aggressively progressive liberal campaign than he did. Would that have done better, do you think, in this district?
Not in this district. I mean, I think there's a case to be made that there are districts in the country where Bernie Sanders' message actually would help win a majority, would help in some tougher territory. But in these suburban districts, and there, a lot of these battlegrounds in 2018 are these affluent suburbs, these seats that have traditionally leaned Republican but are moving towards Democrats. They're suburban. They're in California, Orange County, Dallas, Houston, Atlanta. And these are seats where Bernie Sanders did badly in the Democratic primary and is actually fairly not nearly as popular as he might be nationally. So if Ossoff ran to the base, he would not – you know, he wouldn't be able to add to that 48%, and he probably would do worse with some of these swing voters.
You know, there was an ad, the most controversial ad that was aired in this race was not by either candidate, it was by an outside group that aired an ad that tried to tie John Ossoff to that tragic shooting of Republican members of Congress while they were practicing in a park for a charity baseball game.
Now the unhinged left is endorsing and applauding shooting Republicans. When will it stop? It won't if John Ossoff wins on Tuesday. Because the
Do you think that issue had an effect on this race?
So, Susan, no one wants to talk about that publicly on either side. And there was a quote in I believe, Politico right before the election where a county operative sort of said, yeah, of course it had an impact. Of course, like we're actually getting a little bit of momentum as a result. You know, the reality is I think broadly speaking, there was a lot of opposition to this extreme rhetoric on both sides. People were sick of sort of all the heated rhetoric on both sides of the island. You know, Bob Costa at the Washington Post had a great story from the district right before the election where he talked to some Trump skeptical Republicans, and they basically thought a lot of this Russia stuff was a little bit overhyped. They were skeptical. They were worried about this health care law that's being debated by the Republicans in Washington behind closed doors, but they actually had problems firsthand with Obama's healthcare legislation. So they weren't exactly sure of what to make of healthcare. So these are people that are kind of in the middle. They may not follow the political debates as closely as we do in Washington. And when you have the Kathy Griffin, you know, her holding a bloody fake Donald Trump head, that was something that was actually advertised by one of the mainstream Republican groups. And that actually may have had an impact. So I think when you think of it broadly in terms of just the language, the political polarization that's gone on in the country, that helped Karen handle the very end of this race.
You know, winning an election is better than losing an election. There's no question about that. But one thing that would be a positive for Democrats is that in all of these special elections, these special House elections that we've had this year in Kansas and Montana and South Carolina and Georgia, there have in fact been big swings in the vote compared with the congressional vote from last November. In each case, it just wasn't quite a big enough swing to get Democrats over the finish line. But what does that tell us about what may happen next year when all the members of the House are up?
It suggests that Democrats are going to have a good night, maybe even a very good night. What the results from Georgia showed is, we may be seeing a Category 2, Category 3 storm that wipes out a good number of Republicans in the House. Whether they can get to 24, though, and getting to 24 seats means that you're winning a number of seats in pretty Republican districts. That is a high task. And, you know, the fact that they came up just short in Georgia 6 last night does suggest that it's not going to be easy to get the House back.
You know, I wonder if the biggest effect of this victory for Republicans in Georgia is that, as you said, it may encourage some Republican incumbents to hang on to run for another seat rather than try to avoid a fight that looks really difficult. Does it hurt Democratic recruitment? Because Democrats have been really pleased by some of the candidates they've been recruiting to run in some of these Republican-held seats.
It probably has a minimal effect on the Democratic recruitment because it's already happening. You know, we've already seen a lot of Democratic challengers jump into these races. And to be honest with you, Susan, John Ossoff, for all the attention that he got, for all the money that he raised, he was a pretty unimpressive candidate when you just look at his resume. I mean, look, he was a legislative junior aide to a backbench Democratic Congress, Hank Johnson, a backbench, one of the more junior Democratic members of Congress. And then he spent a couple of years as in a sort of an obscure filmmaker. And then all of a sudden, he was the repository for all this anti-Trump anger across the country. But if he actually was running in November of 2018, we might not even be talking about him. We might not even be paying any attention to him. The reality is Democrats are actually recruiting a lot of accomplished candidates, people who are doctors, lawyers, military veterans, a number of races where Democrats have actually recruited some really decorated military veterans who can actually say, not only am I a centrist Democrat, but here's why. I did this. I'm tougher on national security than your average Democrat. I saved lives because I, helped create a cure to help fight cancer. There are actually candidates that fit those profiles that Democrats have recruited. So this is why I'm not quite as bearish, on Democrats just because of this one race. Ossoff had a lot of money, had a lot of energy behind him. But as a candidate, he was pretty generic. And Democrats have actually done a very good job in the House finding candidates that fit these districts that they're running in.
Some Democrats didn't think he was a great candidate. Some Republicans didn't think Karen Handel was the best possible candidate either.
It's kind of funny. For a race that got the most money paid to it in United States history, these were pretty underwhelming candidates. Handel at least had some experience. She served in as a Secretary of State. She had some local government experience. But if you talk to Republicans privately, they were very frustrated with how she ran her campaign. Her fundraising was fairly, at least initially, was fairly weak. So this was not like the clash of the titans here for such an expensive House race. And what gives Republicans also can look at some of their incumbents too. And the one thing that Republicans are sort of optimistic about is that they have a good set of frontline incumbents that are in tough districts that have shown that they can win in very difficult political environments. So, like Barbara Comstock in Virginia, in the suburbs of D.C. You got Mike Kaufman in suburban Denver. These are going to be top targets for Democrats, but these Republicans have always beat expectations.
There also aren't there, 23 House Republicans who represent districts that Hillary Clinton carried. They've got to be on the top of the list for Democratic targets.
Yeah. And then so Democrats need 24 seats and they've got 23 seats that Hillary Clinton won. And if there's one lesson to learn from maybe last night's results in Georgia, it's that, Democrats are going to do about as good as they did in 2016. So maybe they're going to come right at that 24 number. This Georgia 6 seat was actually number 28 when you look at the Clinton. Trump won the district very narrowly. But if you rank all the Democratic seats based on Clinton's performance, this was number 28 on that list. So, they're close. This is going to be I imagine no matter who wins the House, it's going to be a very long night come next November.
The money in this race. Just unbelievable. $50 million. $200 per vote cast.
It's amazing. I mean, look. Can you imagine what charity or what cause you could have spent the
what personal bank account?
Well, the Atlanta TV stations made a fortune. I mean, they're doing quite well. What's funny is that Ossoff's campaign had more money than they could spend. So they were doing Korean radio ads to try to appeal to the hundreds of Korean voters in the district. They literally left no stone unturned because they just had so much money. They had more than they could do with.
Truly, the winners were the Atlanta area TV stations, including one that added an additional news program to their schedule so they could sell ads against it.
Yeah, no Andy Griffith at 7 o'clock on that station. They actually had a newscast so they could get the extra advertising. So there's probably going to be a timeout on those types of advertisings.
One of the things that was kind of encouraging was how high turnout was. The highest turnout we've seen in a standalone special House election ever. So Democrats started out being totally engaged. Republicans ended up being very engaged as well.
Yeah, I think high turnout is going to be now increasingly seen as a good thing for Republicans in the future. But I was talking to my colleague at the Cook Political Report, David Wasserman, who was telling me that the turnout in this special election exceeded a regular midterm turnout and what we probably can reasonably expect in next year's midterms. So this was historic by any stretch. Democrats were finding voters that don't usually vote. They had an amazing micro-targeting operation. And one of the reasons why Republicans were feeling more optimistic in the run-up to this election is that they actually found that they were getting voters that didn't show up in that first round of balloting that were actually coming out and showing their support for Karen Handel. So we know the Democratic turnout organically because of their dislike for Donald Trump is going to be there. It probably will stay until November of 2018. What Republicans need is that turnout to stay high. So they need their voters who have been pretty disengaged in a lot of these other special elections. They need that turnout and that attention to be paid throughout the election cycle.
Is there a lesson that Republican candidates will take in terms of how to handle Donald Trump?
It was interesting. Karen Handel last night in her victory speech gave this big cheer to the President of the United States.
And a special thanks to the President of the United States of America.
And then mentioned Mike Pence by name.
But let's not forget our equally great Vice President, Mike Pence.
But didn't mention Donald Trump's name. She didn't mention Donald Trump barely throughout the entire campaign. And that was because he's a very polarizing figure. And there are a lot of enough Republicans that don't like President Trump in that district. Trump really is going to be a district by district decision for candidates, because there's some parts of the country where actually Trump is much more popular than he is, on average. But they're suburban districts. They're going to be a lot of urban districts that are big battlegrounds in the House where Trump is toxic. And even in swing districts like Georgia 6, the Republican didn't want to be seen as too close to Donald Trump.
You know, it's risky, though, for a Republican, since Donald Trump continues to be pretty popular among Republicans. So it's risky for a Republican to actually diss him in any way, or even to distance themselves in a public way. So what she did was not embrace him, but mostly try to ignore him.
She didn't want to get into in any controversy where someone's asking whether you support Donald Trump on X, Y, and Z. And we saw what happened in the midterms, or rather in 2016, for Republicans. The two senators, Republican senators at least, who lost these close races were the ones who said, I can't endorse Donald Trump anymore, Kelly Ayotte and Joe Hack in Nevada. They said, I can't support Donald Trump. And then they had to backtrack and they were flip-flopping all over the place. And those were the two Republican senators who lost, whereas most of the Republican senators who basically stood with him throughout the ups and downs of that presidential campaign ended up winning in the election.
We're heading into this big debate about health care. The Senate bill on health care being unveiled. Mitch McConnell, the Senate Republican leader, talks about pushing for a vote next week on this big bill. Does the Georgia results and the fact that Republicans have held all four of these special House election seats, does that help Mitch McConnell get a bill through the Senate?
A little bit on the edges. I think the biggest challenge for Mitch McConnell is that he can only lose two Republican senators, and you still have a lot of differences between the moderate Republican wing, folks like Susan Collins and Bill Cassidy, and other moderates like Rob Portman, and then Ted Cruz, Rand Paul, and Mike Lee, who have totally different views on how healthcare should be implemented. So that's still a problem. It's an issue that McConnell is working the paper over. But what these results do show is that, look, as bad as the Republican Party, as bad as the divisions within the Republican Party are in the era of Trump, if you can keep the party united, if you keep that Trump wing and the Ryan wing together, it still can be a pretty potent force. And I think the lesson Mitch McConnell learned throughout the presidential election campaign is that you need to stay. Don't get trapped into these ways to divide the party. If we stay united and ignore the opportunities for division, we can actually get some stuff done. It hasn't happened so far, but McConnell is increasingly optimistic that, with the politics now behind us, that he can actually get something through the Senate.
I just say the politics are never behind us.
Right, that's true.
There's always politics behind us. Just one last thing. You know, there was another special House election that got not much money, not very much attention in South Carolina. Democrats said it was just too Republican a district for them to even compete seriously. And this was the seat that Mick Mulvaney resigned from to become budget director in the Trump administration. And yet the results were closer than the ones in Georgia, just 3 percentage points. Was this a missed opportunity by Democrats?
I tend not to blame the Democratic Party for not being aggressive in that race, because it likely would have set off a sort of a nuclear arms race in that district. And the benefit that Democrats had in that district is that no one attacked the Democratic nominee. And that's a fairly Republican seat. And the guy was a good candidate, but he had Goldman Sachs connections. He had a lot of opportunities to hit him at. And the Democrats realized that if we get people's attention, if we put this race on the radar, Republicans are going to really go nuclear. So I think they played their cards wisely. They didn't want to draw attention to this district. It's actually a district that Democrats held for most of the last, 30, 40 years. John Spratt, who, was head of the Armed Services Committee for a long time, really did a good job holding down that district. But when the national political winds shifted in 2010, and Mick Mulvaney picked that seat up, and it's been in Republican hands ever since. But it's one of those blue dog type districts that Democrats once had a really good opportunity to win, but the party's direction since 2010 has been one where it's just a really difficult seat to hold.
Last question. In the 2018 midterms, who wins the House?
Boy, let's put it this way. I would have said before Georgia 6, 50-50, flip a coin. Democrats had a really good chance to win. After last night, I would put those odds closer to maybe like 35-40%. It's they still have a decent chance, but not quite as promising as it once looked.
Thanks for joining us, Josh.
Thanks, Susan.
And now from the archives. Earlier this week, the Supreme Court ruled that the government can't block a trademark because it offends some people or groups. The decision undercuts efforts to force Washington's football team, the Redskins, to change its name because some find it racist. In 2014, I hosted a Diane Rehm Show panel on the issue. Here's attorney Bruce Fine, and then Jacqueline Peta, executive director of the National Congress of American Indians.
The government shouldn't be in the business of picking and choosing based upon opinion or public opinion as to what gets government benefits and what not. There's one principle in First Amendment law that's time-honored. Viewpoint discrimination is per se unconstitutional, and that's what's going on here. The people who interpret the word as a disparaging, that viewpoint is viewed as not acceptable, and therefore there's punishing the Washington Redskins by depriving them of a legal right. And that principle, in my judgment, is wrong and could spread to many, many other areas.
Now, if pressure is brought not by the government, but by pressuring sponsors, by some church groups have raised objections, by 50 U.S. senators have signed a letter objecting them. If the pressure came that way and it basically made it necessary politically from business terms to change the name, would you have similar objections?
No, not at all. I think that's how a lot of the gay rights issues have worked out with boycotts and whatever. That's what the democratic process is about. Changing minds, advocacy, that's the difference between civilization and tyranny here. And so I'd defend the rights of everyone to criticize Dan Snyder as they would defend the rights of Dan Snyder to defend himself. That's what free marketplace ideas is about.
So, Jackie, what do you think about that, the objection that, okay, push for the name to be changed, but we shouldn't use the government to do it because of our protection of free speech?
Well, I think that both things are going to happen. I think that the government has responsibility to be able to look at these issues. I'm just like anybody else. I want to protect the rights of free speech. But I also want to be able to make sure that, these terms, such as a term of the Washington team name, which is so disparaging, isn't a term that can be legally used for profit when the federal government has a responsibility. And if the federal government didn't have a trademark review process, then it wouldn't have that responsibility. But it does have a trademark review process, and that's what the Trademark Commission does. And they reviewed it, and they gave their opinion.
You can listen to that entire segment on dianereem.org. That's our show for this week. We'd love to hear what's on your mind. Send us an email at drpodcast@wamu.org. Leave us a voicemail. The number is 202-854-8851. Or find us on Facebook or Twitter. Our theme music was composed by Cliff Harden and comes to us courtesy of the Capitol Soundtrack Project here at WAMU. The show is produced by Sandra Baker and Rebecca Kaufman. Thanks for listening. I'm Susan Page of USA Today.